This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 2 p.m. GMT on Wednesday, the 29th of March, these are our main stories. The European Court of Human Rights is hearing a case brought by 2,000 women accusing the Swiss government of violating their human rights through its failure to act on climate change. Some of the biggest names in global technology are calling for a pause in the development of advanced artificial intelligence. And clerics at the Kyiv-Pechersk Lavra, or Monastery of the Caves in Kyiv, are being evicted by the Ukrainian government amid concerns over their links to the Russian Orthodox Church. Also in this podcast,
specific target group from especially the UK and Italy, who are only coming to Amsterdam with the belief that we are a theme park.
Amsterdam City Council wants to discourage young British people from travelling there. We start with what's being seen as a big legal moment in the fight against climate change. A group of 2,000 women is accusing the Swiss government of violating their human rights through its failure to act. The case will be heard in the European Court of Human Rights. It is the first time the court will hear a case on the impact of climate change on human rights. Elizabeth Stern is one of the plaintiffs.
We do hope that the judges in Strasbourg are free from a political agenda and actually just look at our case in terms of, is climate protection a human right? Because we have a right for life, we have a right for health. Are those articles violated or not? And that's what we want an answer from them.
Imogen Folks is our correspondent in Switzerland, and I asked her what the legal case for these women was.
Well, they have gone to the court in Strasbourg armed with their medical records, and it is proven that older people are, particularly with heat waves, more affected. Their health is more affected. So they've gone with their own records with, you know, cases of breathlessness, dizziness, just having to stay in for days or sometimes weeks on end with these ever more frequent heat waves that we get in Switzerland now. And what they are saying is this situation violates our right to health, possibly right to life, because there is a higher mortality rate during these heat waves. And it violates our right to a family life because we have to stay in, you know, we can't go out and see people, we can't enjoy life as we normally would. So that is their case. We should say the European Court does not have a right to a healthy environment on its statute book. But what it does have is the right to life, right to health and right to family life. So that is their case.
Now, this is the first case of its kind. As such, how important is it?
It's hugely important because the court could potentially order Switzerland to do more to tackle climate change, work harder at reducing its greenhouse gas emissions. That's one of the key things these Swiss women want. And if it does that, that is a precedent then, not just for Switzerland, but for the 46 member states of the Council of Europe who are part of the European Court of Human Rights. And this is the first case, but it's not the last. Later this afternoon, in fact, there is a case coming from France, and then over the course of the next couple of months, a case coming from young people in Portugal. So very, very interesting time, and it will be very interesting to see what the outcome of this first case is.
That was Imogen Folks. Warnings of artificial intelligence outsmarting us and causing mayhem in some dystopian way have not come to pass yet, but some of the biggest names in global technology are now calling for a pause in the development of advanced AI until appropriate safety measures have been developed and implemented. The letter from them comes just a couple of weeks after the release of OpenAI's GPT-4, which is the most powerful AI system ever released. It's led to fears that we are rapidly and unwittingly heading towards catastrophe. In the letter, the signatories pose the following questions.
Should we let machines flood our information channels with propaganda and untruth? Should we automate away all the jobs, including the fulfilling ones? Should we develop non-human minds that might eventually outnumber, outsmart, obsolete, and replace us? Should we risk a loss of control of our civilization? Such decisions must not be delegated to unelected tech leaders.
There are some big names on the list of signatories, like Elon Musk, Apple's co-founder Steve Wozniak, and Sean O'Hegarty, who's director of the AI Futures and Responsibility Programme at the University of Cambridge. He spoke to the BBC's Sarah Montague.
It seems a bit funny to be calling for a pause in AI progress, given how exciting all this progress is and the beneficial applications that there will be of it. But there are a bunch of practical issues with the systems that we're deploying at the moment, from making up false facts to exacerbating potential inequalities through to propagating bias in the data sources. And it's becoming increasingly difficult for governance to keep up with it. We've seen a rhetoric emerging recently, particularly amongst the tech companies, and that they're all in a race to develop large models and to release them. And we've already seen some kind of smaller scale examples of problems with these systems. Microsoft chatbot went off the rails a few times and threatened a journalist. Galactica from Meta had to be taken offline last year after it was making up fake scientific papers. And so I don't know if we necessarily need a pause this year on AI progress on the largest models, but I think it's a good time to be starting to think about this conversation in order to have time to really work on the safety, reliability of these systems, and in order to have time for governance to really catch up and for us to be engaging in a proactive way with the development of these systems rather than reactively after they're out.
All the things that you, the examples you've given, are cases where they could pull the plug on it. What is the particular fear about this sort of escaping that ability?
Well, I guess the first thing is you can pull the plug, but sometimes it might already have caused harm. There's also practical applications, like people are using large models to help them with cyber hacking competitions. So you can easily imagine a bad actor using a system like this to better do cyber attacks.
And is it the fear of what bad actors, how bad actors could use this technology? Or do you fear that the technology itself could, well, in some way become evil? And after all, it's something that, for the first tool in human history, that has the ability to make decisions.
I would say that at present, I'm worried about use by bad actors and unintended consequences and impacts on things like jobs and inequality. In the longer term, there are concerns about whether we could have systems that escape our control. It's part of our remit to think about these issues. They're not the immediate concern, but a lot of the same steps that will allow us good governance with the issues ahead of us are the kind of initial steps I think we need to be taking for the longer term issues.
That was Sean O'Hegarty from Cambridge University. A report by a British think tank says Russia's security and intelligence services have had far more success than its army following the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It says Russia's FSB counterintelligence service has been able to swiftly dominate areas that it's occupied. Frank Gardner has the details.
Russia's FSB spy service, the successors to the KGB, has reportedly been operating in Russian-controlled areas of Ukraine with ruthless efficiency, in marked contrast to the poor performance of the army. In a new report published today, the main author, Jack Watling, said FSB officers would organise themselves in groups, seizing government records for each area, then downloading the computer hard drives. These then revealed the addresses of anyone connected to the Ukrainian state, who would then be arrested in house-to-house searches and frequently tortured during interrogation. Meanwhile, electronic warfare units would cut off access to Ukrainian TV and radio, as well as the internet, giving the FSB and GRU military intelligence near total dominance in occupied areas.
That was Frank Gardner. Well, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has indirectly led to a struggle for control of the country's most revered Orthodox Christian site. Today, clerics at the Kiev-Pechersk Lavra, or Monastery of the Caves, in Kiev, are being evicted by the Ukrainian government amid concerns over their links to the Russian Orthodox Church, from which it split recently. I heard more from BBC Monitoring's Vitaly Shevchenko.
It's one of the two main surviving ancient Christian sites in Ukraine. It dates back to the 11th century. It's this huge, beautiful, sprawling complex in Kiev, and it's owned by the state, and it was leased by the Ukrainian Orthodox Church for free, and now the authorities are saying it's time to leave.
And why is that?
The Ukrainian Orthodox Church is one of the two main Orthodox churches in Ukraine. And until recently, it was part of the Russian Orthodox Church. And it declared independence from Moscow after the invasion of Ukraine started last year. However, the Ukrainian authorities say that no, you're still part of the Russian Church. You harbor Russian secret agents, you spread pro-Russian ideas, and the authorities in Ukraine, they conducted a wave of searches across numerous churches run by this particular church last year, and they found Russian currency, Russian books. So what happens next is less clear, because the monks and the priests at the complex, they are saying that they are not going to go at this moment in time. There's lots of believers milling about in this large complex. Priests are behaving defiantly. They're talking to the media saying, no, we're not going. But at the same time, there have been reports of them taking their belongings out of this monastery. And the Ukrainian authorities are equally vague about what happens next. They're saying they've got to leave the Pechersk Lavra, but the secretary of the Ukrainian Security Council, Alexei Danilov, was just speaking to the media, and he said they're not going to use force to, and I quote, to drag these people out of the monastery. So let's see what happens next.
Well, Russia has been reacting. Dmitry Peskov, Vladimir Putin's press spokesman, has said that the demand that the clerics leave the monastery was illegitimate and unacceptable. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has reacted angrily to comments by President Joe Biden of the US, who urged him to walk away from his controversial judicial reform plans. These include limiting the powers of Israel's Supreme Court. The proposals have led to weeks of mass protests. From Jerusalem, Tom Bateman reports.
Mr. Biden said the Israeli leader should abandon his hugely controversial judicial reforms, currently on hold for several weeks, saying Israel cannot continue down this road.
Like many strong supporters of Israel, I'm very concerned. And I'm concerned that they get this straight. They cannot continue down this road. And I've sort of made that clear. Hopefully, the Prime Minister will act in a way that he's going to try to work out some genuine compromise, but that remains to be seen.
The US has been dialing up the pressure on Mr. Netanyahu, fearing his plans endanger Israel's image as a democracy. The Israeli PM, clearly angered, took to Twitter late at night in response, saying Israel was a sovereign country which makes its own decisions, not based on pressures from abroad, including, he said, from the best of friends. Mr. Biden had said he wasn't interfering, but seemed to brim with scepticism when he referred to Mr. Netanyahu's apparent attempts now to reach a compromise over the plans.
Tom Bateman. Still to come.
Hello, everybody. This is Arthur Briggs and his band playing. Are you ready, boys?
Yes! Yeah.
Arthur Briggs, who helped bring jazz to Europe, who was living a lie.
Abnormal transactions.
Some kind of cyber attack on a bank.
Tens of millions of dollars.
Something I don't think anybody has seen before.
It's a cyber criminal group.
From the BBC World Service.
The Lazarus Heist is back for season two.
It was really like in the movies.
Find out more at the end of this podcast.
The president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, has set off on a 10-day trip to Central America to visit Guatemala and Belize. They are two of the very few nations that officially recognise Taiwan as an independent country. But those destinations aren't the only reason the trip's controversial. It will also include two stopovers in New York on the way there and Los Angeles on the way back. And this has caused outrage in Beijing, particularly the proposed meeting between the Taiwan president and the US House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. I'll be getting more details from our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow.
In essence, as we've spoken about many times on this programme, China believes that Taiwan is a part of its own territory, and it discourages any international contact between foreign officials and the leaders of the island of Taiwan. So even the visit to Guatemala and Belize is controversial because China just simply doesn't want any country to recognise Taiwan as a country. But as you identified there, it's the trip to America which is causing most concern. Of course, America, despite not having official ties with Taiwan, has a lot of links with Taiwan. Taiwan has an unofficial embassy there, and America has a representative office in Taiwan. So it's these links, this link with America, which is most problematic for China. It just basically doesn't want to see the United States give any support whatsoever to anybody in Taiwan. And so that's why it's reacted as it has done. It says this trip by Tsai Ing-wen is a provocation. For her part, Tsai Ing-wen, just before she left Taiwan, said she won't yield to any kind of pressure and will continue to pursue this policy, which she has done throughout her presidency, of trying to engage with the outside world, despite what China has said.
Michael, I suppose this is just one of a series of stress tests for the relationship between the US and China. How serious is it?
I mean, as you mentioned there, yeah, there are other issues between China and the United States, trade, military, potential military conflict, lots of issues. This is just one of them, but it is a major flashpoint. China is unswerving, really, in its determination that one day Taiwan will unify with the mainland. United States, particularly over recent years, has shown increasing support for Taiwan. So it is a real flashpoint and a potential starting point for an even bigger development in their relationship. And if you remember just last year, Nancy Pelosi, who was then the House Speaker in the United States, visited Taiwan, and China launched a major military exercise around Taiwan following that. So it's not a small thing in China's eyes.
That was Michael Bristow. Just over 2 weeks ago, Cyclone Freddy made landfall in Southeast Africa, leaving a trail of devastation across the region. In the worst hit country, Malawi, over 500 people were killed and over 500,000 people displaced. Floods and mudslides swept away homes, roads and bridges. Moses Kunkuya, Malawi's Minister of Information and Civic Education and a former MP for Blantyre, one of the worst affected cities, told us about the current situation.
Many people are still displaced. We have over 700 camps now where we are holding these people, providing shelter, providing food and other forms of care. So the situation is still dire because most of the roads that were washed away, over 40 bridges were washed away. Those places are still difficult to access so that we can provide relief items to the people that are in those areas. There is a risk now of waterborne diseases and other diseases due to the congestion in the centres that these people are being kept. So even the health sector is now overwhelmed as well. The education sector remains affected because most of the camps that have been created, they are at schools. Apart from schools being damaged, over 500 schools being damaged physically, the other schools are also being used as camps for the people that have been displaced. So with schools now due for reopening, we have to make tough decisions of moving people from those schools to other temporary shelters like tents so that the children can return to school. It's too dire. Moving those that have been completely displaced, they have nowhere to go. We are moving them to temporary shelters. So we are receiving tents and we are still pleading for more assistance in that regard because the two have to be balanced. School has to reopen and we still have to take care of the people. But talking of permanent structures, that will definitely take time and it's in the long-term plans.
That was Moses Kunkuyu. Next to the controversy surrounding America's largest bank, JP Morgan, and the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. He was one of the lender's biggest clients who died in prison whilst he was facing charges of running a sex trafficking ring. Now the boss of JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon, is to be interviewed under oath about his bank's decision to retain Epstein as a client. The bank denies any wrongdoing. Monica Miller has been speaking to Financial Times legal correspondent Joe Miller, who broke the story.
All of this stems from two lawsuits that were filed late last year, one by an alleged Epstein victim, goes by the pseudonym of Jane Doe, and another by the US Virgin Islands, which is where Jeffrey Epstein had one of his homes. And these suits are against JP Morgan. They allege that JP Morgan, which banked Epstein for 15 years from 1998 to 2013, benefited from human trafficking because it ignored several internal warnings about Epstein's behavior and his sex crimes. But Jamie Dimon was just incidentally named in this suit because his name came up in discovery, which is when lawyers for the plaintiff start getting documents from the other side. And there was one piece of internal communication which referenced a Dimon review, supposedly into whether to retain Epstein as a client. The bank says Dimon has no recollection of, and there are no records of, and things have escalated since then. The bank had tried to make sure that Dimon did not have to answer questions under oath, but this is going to happen in May, so he's no longer able to swerve direct questioning about how much he knew and when.
How has it come to the point where the chief executive of America's biggest bank is now being dragged into this case?
Well, I think it's fair to say that, and I can't speak for the plaintiff's lawyers, but that the discovery in these cases, which have been combined for pretrial purposes, has unearthed new facts that have surprised almost all of the parties involved. It also unearthed an enormous trove of communications between Jess Staley, who used to be a very senior executive at JP Morgan. You may know his name because he went on to become CEO of Barclays. He looked after the Epstein account for many years, and what was unearthed in discovery were more than 1,200 emails and communications between him and Epstein, some of which allegedly contained pictures of women. And these new facts were so stark that it led JP Morgan to itself sue Staley and try and make him carry the liability if JP Morgan is successfully sued in these cases. And Staley himself is going to be deposed in April, and now Dimon will be deposed after Staley is deposed by JP Morgan's lawyers. But all of this has essentially come about because so many facts have been unveiled, which the parties claim were previously unknown, and that it has led to these two lawsuits, which, you know, were filed with barely a whisper at the end of last year, becoming ever more high profile.
That was FT legal correspondent Joe Miller. And just to reiterate, the claims laid out in the lawsuits have been denied by JP Morgan, whose lawyers describe them as meritless. Now, post-pandemic lockdown, tourist hotspots are falling over themselves trying to lure people back. But Amsterdam City Council wants to be more discerning. It has just launched a campaign aimed at discouraging young British people, mostly men, from travelling there for what it calls a messy night in search of drugs, sex and alcohol. The online initiative, which targets 18 to 35-year-old men in the UK, will see discouraging adverts triggered when search items like stag party, cheap hotel or pub crawl in Amsterdam are typed in. Claire Martins, a councillor for Amsterdam, says tourists were welcome if they have respect for the city.
Since the last years, all the British hen parties found Amsterdam as their place to party. I mean, there are families living over there. They see, unfortunately, Amsterdam as a theme park, and it's not livable anymore. So we ask our mayor to find a solution to make Amsterdam more livable for the people who live actually in Amsterdam. If you really would like to come for our shops, our restaurants, our great museum, for example, you are more than welcome. It's a very specific target group from especially the UK and Italy, who are only coming to Amsterdam with the belief that we are a theme park.
The BBC's Anna Holligan is in Amsterdam.
Around a million British tourists travel here to Schiphol Airport and on to Amsterdam every year. And the council now has a message for young British men, and that is stay away. This is a digital discouragement campaign. So if you're in the UK and you search for terms like Stag Weekend Amsterdam, Cheap Hotel Amsterdam, Pub Crawl Amsterdam, then these warning adverts will pop up and they show things like a young man staggering in the street, being handcuffed by police, detained, having his fingerprints and mugshots taken. And the message is, If you're coming to Amsterdam, which is notoriously, some would say, Europe's most liberal party capital, for a while time, then stay away, because you might just create the kinds of lifelong memories that won't serve you well in the future. So they're trying to deter the drunken, disorderly, stoned kind of behaviour that residents have been complaining about for a long time. They have told me in the past about British tourists peeing in the streets, in the canals, being sick everywhere, getting naked, and that's the kind of behaviour they want to get rid of. But actually, I've been speaking to young Brits arriving here at Schiphol, and many of them say it's outrageous, we're being stereotyped in this way, this is discrimination. And in fact, that kind of sentiment is echoed among some coffee shop, cannabis cafe owners I've spoken to. One told me, well, they might come for the weed, but then they stay for the Van Gogh. And some of the families who live along the beautiful canal network have told me in the past that it's not necessarily the young British men who are causing the problems, it's over tourism in general, it's the sheer number. So this is part of Amsterdam City Council's effort to try to rebrand the capital's rather raunchy reputation, partly created by the cannabis cafes in the red light district, and they hope that if it's successful in the UK, it will be rolled out across other EU capitals and here in the Netherlands too.
That was Anna Holligan. It's a name not widely known, Arthur Briggs, unless you're a fan of early jazz, of course. He was a trumpeter who played a central role in bringing jazz to Europe in the 1920s and 1930s. What no one knew at the time is that he was not, as he claimed to be, an American, but a son of the British Empire, having been born in Grenada in the West Indies at the turn of the century. Arthur Briggs lived most of his life in Paris. Our correspondent there, Hugh Schofield, has been unearthing the adventures and the secrets of a forgotten British Caribbean great.
Hello, everybody. This is Arthur Briggs and his band playing. Are you ready, boy?
Yes!
From the late 1920s, Arthur Briggs was the best-known name in Europe performing the new hot music. Critics called him Europe's answer to Louis Armstrong. Audiences danced to his cornet in Berlin, Vienna, Paris and the Riviera.
He was absolutely synonymous with jazz throughout Europe. You know, he's tilling the soil. He's traveling to all these places and introducing people who had no concept of this sort of syncopation yet.
Biographer Travis Attria. Researchers into Arthur Briggs's life and music have one priceless asset, a long archive interview he made in 1982 for Rutgers University in the US.
You had brass, you had trombones, you had trumpets.
Over the course of 7 hours of tapes, never before broadcast, Briggs recounts his adventures as a young black musician travelling around Europe. In the 30s, Arthur Briggs settled in Paris, where he helped set up the famous Hot Club and played with greats like Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli. But then came war, and Briggs was interned by the Nazis outside Paris. Here there's another great scene. Briggs, who leads a camp orchestra, conducts a concert of Beethoven, which is attended by Nazi top brass. Afterwards, he's approached by the commanding officer of the German army in France, Otto von Stulpnagel. Travis Attria takes up the tale.
Von Stulpnagel says to him in English, "I never thought it was possible." Meaning, I never thought that a black man could play Beethoven. I mean, and Briggs says to him in perfect German, because Briggs has learned how to speak German by this point through all his travels. He says to him in German, "There's a lot that you don't know." And to me, that moment is the absolute climax of Briggs's life. The guts it took.
Arthur Briggs spanned the century. He died in 1991. Today, living in the same flat in Montmartre, is his daughter Barbara, born in 1960 after her father gave up playing and started a new family life.
My mum, who was very young, worked in the office, and my dad took care of me, and he only worked 2 days a week in the musical school.
That must have given you a very special relationship with
him. Of course, it was. It was a special relationship, yeah.
Arthur Briggs rarely spoke to Barbara about his past fame as a jazz man, nor did he like to talk about the great secret of his early life. Here he is again from the archive.
I was born in Charleston, South Carolina, 10th of April.
But that statement was simply not true. Arthur Briggs was born in Grenada. He came to Harlem, New York, only as a teenager. Throughout his working life in the 20s and 30s, he travelled on a British passport, but to the end, he insisted he was American. Jazz historian Rainer Lotz.
He told the same story to every interviewer and made up his early life. He invented persons. He invented people that he claimed to have known. Very strange.
Arthur Briggs, the only British subject known to have taken part in the creation, growth, and spread of jazz.
That report was by Hugh Schofield. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly Forster, and the producer was Rachel Wright. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Cyber attack, army payments scheme.
A series of increasingly sophisticated cybercrimes being carefully orchestrated around the world.
The attraction to target ATMs is fairly obvious. I mean, they're full of cash.
It was just like abracadabra. Put these cards, put any PIN number, and you get money.
Jackpot.
US investigators say the heists are being carried out by the Lazarus Group, a criminal hacking gang who are said to be working under the orders of the North Korean state.
Tens of millions of dollars for the North Koreans.
These actors are not as anonymous as they think they are.
The group's goal? To steal money to help fund the country's growing ballistic missile and nuclear program.
But despite evidence suggesting otherwise, North Korea denies any involvement.
In season two of The Lazarus Heist, from the BBC World Service, we're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
And piles of stolen cash.
Over $2 billion. We're at $2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Search for The Lazarus Heist, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.